On this episode, we will be taking a closer look at a world-renowned tea company, Dilmah Tea, which has seen phenomenal success since its humble beginnings, which started off as a family business in Sri Lanka in 1988 by Meryl Fernando. And his son, who is the CEO right now, joins me on this show to talk about preserving the family's legacy and also navigating the challenges and complexities to date. Thank you so much, Dilhan, and welcome to Kuala Lumpur. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here, and especially to know that we have a Sri Lankan in our midst.
Well, as you have pointed out, I am partially Sri Lankan, so very excited to actually talk about what you have right here, the tea itself, the tea business. But also, I want to start with what's happening, of course, in Sri Lanka with the crisis that's unfolding, the economic and political crisis. How has it been for you as running a business? And we know that Dilmah Tea is synonymous with Sri Lanka. It's perhaps the best export out of Sri Lanka.
Well, Sri Lanka has had a history of challenges. We had a conflict for many years. We had the Easter bombings. We had a pandemic. But resilience is something that has marked Sri Lanka, and the Sri Lankan people have been incredible in that way. So I'm very confident that we will overcome and that Sri Lanka will rise again. But as for the challenges of a business, yes, you have to be resourceful. And I think the one thing about a challenge, and I think this might be sort of touching upon a cliche, but the one thing about a challenge is that it forces you to rethink. And if there is one thing that this recent global experience of the pandemic has done, is that it has changed everything. And there's nothing like change to prompt change. So you need to look at diversification, you need to look at innovation, better ways of doing things, better solutions, but also the role of business. Mm-hmm. Business was once tasked many years ago with making profit, but no more, because today a business is part of an ecosystem. We realize that health, wellness, the social aspects, the environmental aspects, all of these are part of the purpose of business. And that brings me to my father's purpose. And that is something that drives us today, and it has taken us through this challenge.
I want to get to that a bit later on the show. Just staying on Sri Lanka a bit, with what's happening, of course, there's a lot of focus about what can be done to help the country emerge out of this. What has been the conversation, especially among corporates and your colleagues, in that obligation to help the country to emerge out of this better?
Well, I think we've all looked at it positively. Because, Cynthia, the fact is that this began and it continues at the moment as a people's movement. And mm-hmm. it was ordinary people of different social strata who came out onto the streets and said, look, we want change. So in that sense, it's great that the people have drawn a line and said, look, we will not tolerate nepotism. We will not tolerate corruption. We will not tolerate incompetence at government, because the world is struggling at the moment. There is a threat of a global economic recession, and therefore we need to be much more agile, we need to be mm-hmm. smarter, we need leaders who understand and who give us solutions rather than create problems. And so in this sense, we are optimistic, because since independence, we have had the most part populist governments, because Sri Lanka was once a very rich country, and they have progressively given away everything mm-hmm. from looking at even this organic situation. It was created by the fact that fertilizer was given away. It was subsidized to an extent where there was waste. But ultimately, if you price and use certain mechanisms to control and to ensure judicious use, then you balance sustainability with the commercial viability as well as the food security of a nation. But things like that have been terrible decisions. So there was no way we could continue in the same way. So we are positive.
All right. So starting from a clean slate.
It needs to be.
All right. How has it impacted business, too, with rising record high inflation and fuel shortages? Has costs increased for you?
Absolutely. Costs have increased. But we have to understand that even globally, we have the logistics situation. We have probably that has been the single biggest cost increase for us, where shipping rates have increased exponentially, unjustifiably, too. Locally, yes, costs, not only the actual cost of energy and so on, but also the cost of making sure that your people are okay, or food aid to your staff, to your community, and so on. So I think most businesses who are able to have shouldered that responsibility. And that's nice to see the community coming together, mm-hmm. not only the businesses, the NGOs, the and the local people of every walk of life.
staying on that just a bit about cost, will you have to pass it on to customers?
We would like to, but it's really not possible. And you know, you have to look at it philosophically, because a business builds reserves for a time such as this. You cannot say, yes, you build your reserves and you keep building and you don't use it. Mm-hmm. No, but it is at this time that we need to dip into our reserves and understand that a business cannot always continue to be profitable. In order to build its sustainability, you've also got to say, look, there's going to be good years and bad years. This is a tough year, but the more we do to this year to invest in our people, to help them through this crisis, but also invest in innovation, diversification, and changing the business model from pre to post-pandemic, or the so-called new normal, the better we are going to come out of this
and
crisis.
And you have a very large workforce, 10,000?
We have in excess of 10,000 if you consider a plantation team as well.
How are you supporting them in such a volatile times? And it's not just this year. We've talked about the Easter bombings and then the pandemic and now the economic and political crisis. It's a triple whammy. And how will the people and the country emerge out of this, and how, what is Dilmati doing to support that?
That's a critical point. You know, my father built our business on a very simple philosophy of family business serving humanity through kindness to people and nature. And so that gives us tremendous clarity, as it did in March 2020 when I approached him and I said, look, we are probably going into headwinds like we've never faced before. And his instruction was very clear: look after our people. Mm-hmm. And so with that clarity, we were able to say, okay, A, we will not retrench anyone. We will not cut salaries. We will make sure our people are looked after. And in addition, we've in the plantations, we've you know, food aid every few months, medical assistance, prenatal, all, you know, the needs on a tea garden. It's quite unique, because we are in a, I guess in a sense, an archaic system where the British built a system where from the cradle to the grave, they called it, you live on the plantation. Right. So now you have, why I called it archaic is that 80% of the people who live on our plantations may not work for us. In most cases, they don't. So you're still obliged to look after them to an extent, because they're living on the property. But the situation is not that easy for the plantations either. So we do our best with the food aid, with the medical camps and so on. But this is normal, because whatever you do for your people, you will get back in the form of the resilience to build back.
And this is the value that your father had inculcated since he started business back in 19...
I consider it a blessing, because had I been in a business where they said, look, money is everything, I really can't imagine how we would A, face this crisis, mm-hmm. and B, face ourselves and our conscience looking in the mirror in the morning. So I think in that sense, this family values and family business, it's something very special, which I feel blessed to be a part of.
So when your father started the business, I think he faced a different kind of challenges. You know, he was one of the first to stand up again, you know, to the system and sold tea directly to customers. Now it's a different kind of challenge. What was it like watching your father start and grow the business as a kid? And you joined when you were 20, I believe.
I never realized what he was doing. I saw him struggling. I saw him working late. He works Saturdays. You know, people invite him to dinner. He'll go to dinner. And then in the after dinner, he'll go to the port and he'll go and check on his container. Did it load, etc., etc. But today, in retrospect, what he did was incredible, in the sense that he was, in every sense, the original disruptor, because he had a vision that even his fellow countrymen, even his sons, couldn't quite grasp. Because he said, look, here is our produce. It's a finished good when it comes out of our factories. Why do we have to send it all to London? Why do we have to send it all to New York or wherever for value to be added there? We need to add value here, A, to be able to give our workers the possibility of educating their children, benefiting their family, but also B, for nature, for sustainability. And today it's more relevant than ever, because we, as producers, we are at the front line of climate change. We need the resources, and we need a fairer share of the income, the revenue from the sale of our produce, to be able to implement agroforestry, to be able to transition plantations, which we inherited from a past time, to be able to transition it to be more climate resilient, to be able to help the workers' livelihoods and so on. So it is hugely relevant. And today, we really appreciate, in hindsight, unfortunately, what he achieved.
Well, let's talk about that climate change you pointed out. I imagine that harvesting, cultivating tea has become more tenuous because of extreme, extreme weather conditions. How is Dilma Tea navigating that?
Well, it's challenging, and I think the point is that we have to adapt. We are incorporating new technologies. Mm-hmm. I call it a new technology, but it's actually ancient one, going back to the time of the Incas. Biochar, which charges with certain nutrients and also absorbs moisture when it's placed in the root system. There are so many natural agricultural options. The solutions to climate mitigation are very obvious. It's just a question of adopting a mindset. Of course, it's experimental. I'm not saying it's a one-size-fits-all, mm-hmm. but we need to trial. At the moment, we are trialing this amazing product from Holland, which is natural. It's a great fertilizer. Biochar is brilliant. Agroforestry, there are so many methods, but the transitioning and managing the change is the challenge. Once we help our team to say, okay, look, in the past, we inherited a system from our colonial masters that said, look, you know, cut everything and put down 100 acres of tea. Today, it's about agroforestry, it's about mixing, it's about biological diversity and so on. Because ultimately, look at the assets you have. If you build biodiversity, you have the birds that come and help you with your pest control. You have, if you build rainwater ponds and so on, you have the frogs that come and keep the root system clean. It's a different mindset. So that is the challenge we have, to manage that change.
How's it been to get your people on board with something that is relatively new and foreign to them?
Well, it's not easy. And I know that sometimes when I talk about this stuff, you know, we have a climate change research center in Sri Lanka on Queensbury Estate. And we work with a lot of universities. And I'm really privileged to be able to interact with some of these scientists. And the solutions since 2005, I don't know if you've heard of the Stern Report, but there's a fantastic report by the British government talking about climate adaptation. And since then, the solutions have been patently clear. But since then, the challenge has been getting into the heads mm-hmm. of people who say, no, this is the way we've done it and this is the way we're going to do it. That cultural change, it's not as simple as one may think. Yes, I've met the scientist, understood, and I've seen the trials, but you have people growing paddy who've done it for generations. And telling them change the ways is not easy. It's the same with a tea planter because they inherit a tradition of generations that goes back to the time of the British, and telling them, okay, look, you're no longer going to plant in neat rows, you're not going to go haphazard, and you're going to put a tree here, you're going to put a fruit tree here, etc. It's a challenge because they are not equipped to handle that, but with effective change management, we'll do it.
I think it's also very important because you want younger generation to be in the business, the tea business,
yes.
which has always been seen as a more traditional, hard labor, manual kind of work, and to have that kind of innovation and to move up the value chain. Just wondering your thoughts about that.
I see no problem there for two reasons. One, there is a fresh appreciation of tea. Mm. You have a new generation, so-called Gen Z, plus the millennials, who are looking for herbs, for beverages that are natural, that are authentic, that have natural goodness. And tea is unique in its natural antioxidant, the plant antioxidants. And so it means it boosts immunity. It helps the body reduce the impact of stress. It protects against dementia, against heart stroke, etc. So taking all of that into context, it is also a herb that if you grow tea today, bring a plant from Darjeeling, where you have this soft muscatel note, and plant it in Norelia, you're going to get a very different tea. Why? Because the plant is the same, but the terroir, mm-hmm. and so the terroir, the sense of place,
right.
the sunshine, the soils, etc. And so you have a herb that is so influenced by nature, that is, it is really, in a very sincere sense, it's crafted by nature. And marrying that those demand-side factors and the allure of tea as a natural herbal drink. I mean, and also it works. Some things we'll be doing here in KL is talking about tea mixology, tea gastronomy. So tea and its natural, the fingerprint of nature on tea lends itself brilliantly to contemporary lifestyles. But then you connect that with precision agriculture, looking at AI mm-hmm. in agriculture and so on. We have rich potential for a younger generation to come in.
So let's talk about brand story and how it's very important, especially to younger generations, you know, the Gen Zs, the millennials, and just to know about the brand. Tell me what you're doing with regards to that at Dilmah.
Well, going back to 2020 and 21, we had webinars, we had schools of tea, we had brew academies, we talked about tea, and it was incredible the engagement that we had, because we talked about this leaf, we talked about the influence of nature, how sunshine crafts the brightness, how the soils, the influence of heaven, earth, and only finally the tea maker. I tasted tea and taught people how to taste tea online. It was fantastic and we had brilliant engagement. But where the story is concerned, it's incredible. It's a story of human endeavor. It's a story of benign disruption that is not upsetting anyone, but disrupting a category for the better. And it's a story of a man from a lower middle class rural background. And what are the odds 2 years after independence? It was impossible. So it's really the story of the achievement of an impossible dream through faith and commitment and dedication. And the wonderful thing is I just have to tell the truth. And like right here in KL, I've been talking to so many people and simply telling them the story. Now we're in the third generation. My son has joined the business and I'm hoping my brother's daughters will do the same. And eventually with this story, they also have an incredible heritage. But people are, they do love the story, but there's got to be the substance. They've got to be able to also have a taste and say, yeah, okay, I agree what this guy is saying. It's probably true.
Well, so, tea definitely runs in your blood. I think what's fascinating, of course, Dilmah Tea proves that a family business can be a model for global success if managed well. What's the secret here? Because when we talk about legacy business, there's always a question if it can thrive beyond the first, second, and then the third and fourth generation. Usually is when things maybe fall apart. So how do you keep this running? Is there plans to just keep this in the family?
Well, there's one word I can tell you which is very unbusinesslike in order to break the third generation curse. And I think that word is humility. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I talk to my children every day.
Right.
It's something that my father has taught me and my grandmother taught him. And I think it is that which more than anything will ensure that the continuity of the business. When you enter a business with humility and you understand that this is not something that you are entitled to, but rather it is a blessing, because success in a very real sense is a blessing, because if you look at the guy in the street, maybe the person who's cleaning the street, i.e. probably works harder than most of us, but you are chosen because you have the ability, you know that you are able to pass on, you are able to share your profits. And my father tells me this all the time. He says, success comes to those who are blessed to know and accept that they must share the success. You should be a conduit. You should never be a sort of a dam and say, you know, it's mine, it's mine, it's mine. That breeds arrogance. And of course, then it's a slippery slope. So I think that more than anything, but beyond that is the fact that, yes, in family business, you understand several principles. One is that family values dictate that you must be kind. You know, as human beings, we're all kind, but when we come together as a corporate body, why should we be unkind and focus only on these concepts of shareholder value and profit? And no, that's wrong. It's simply about kindness. And more than anything, in this post-pandemic or new normal era, we have learned the importance, not only kindness to people, but also kindness to nature. Because if we are not kind to nature, if we don't understand that we cannot be parasitic upon our environment nor upon our community, we have to be benign, we have to have a synergistic relationship, well then it's going to be a very unhappy time, not only for the stakeholders in the business, but also for the immediate environment. We are a product of our ecosystem, we are part of that ecosystem, and we must contribute to that ecosystem. And that's what my father showed me, it's what I share with my children, and it is what will take our business beyond the third generation.
What are some of the most critical lessons you've learned from your father about money, running a business, that you may want to impart to your son when he eventually, hopefully, takes over?
You know, for many years, we have struggled. I remember when I first joined the business, my father told me, talk about pure origin, talk about freshness, talk about the hand-picking, talk about what we do. We taste 10,000 teas each week. We share our earnings, etc. For years, I did this you know, people say, yeah, okay, but your price. And I went back to my father and I said, look, you know, they're telling us, look, reduce the price, blend the teas. He said, no, do the right thing and success will come. Do the right thing. And I went year after year. It took maybe 20 years before we began to have an appreciation of provenance, of authenticity. Mm-hmm. That's only recently come.
Yeah.
So, you know, in 2008 with EDLP and everyday low price and discount culture and so on, it became much worse.
Yeah.
But it's only in recent years. And exactly what he said has happened. Yes, we persevered. Yes, we lost a lot of money. We spent a lot of time knocking on doors and having doors shut. But focus on doing the right thing. And the profits and the money that too many people focus on, all of that will follow. But do the right thing first and the profits will follow.
That's such a wonderful philosophy to have. The economic collapse, of course, in Sri Lanka, I believe, did not slow down Dilma at all. You're expanding your footprint to other countries. Right now, over 100 locations, countries around the world, some 3,000 plus products that you have. What's next for Dilma?
Well, you know, we're looking at diversification in the sense that our core will always be tea. So we have our Dilma tea, we have our tea tourism. We've just presented in Malaysia, in Singapore, and several other countries. We've offered our Dilma iced tea, but it's still in the same line. We also, with our tea, we grow spices, cinnamon, and and different kind of herbs and spices. So we are presenting Ayurveda-inspired infusions, and it's on the same lines of wellness, of goodness, of produce, of passion, commitment, and sustainability. And we will continue with chais and so on, but always on the same line, respecting tea at the heart.
So with so many locations you're in right now, are there particular areas that you might want to ramp up efforts in?
Yes, in hospitality, because of course hospitality is opening up now post-pandemic. That was a challenging time. But consumers are more ready than ever to hear our message. And the message is a strong one because we're talking about immune boosting, we're talking about good health, we're talking about good taste and variety. So people are more adventurous in taste today than ever before. But the pairing of tea with food is one, really explosive ikan bilis that I had this morning, or whether it's a foie gras or something softer, more European, you have a tea that will pair with it, that will dignify it, that will also emulsify the fats and help the body synthesize the sugars. And so when you consider all of this, you have a very powerful story. And I believe that in hospitality, where we can share these experiences, that together with our own tea lounges and brew academies, and we have a concept called Brew 1867. These are the experiences that we will be sharing.
How do you see Dilma Tea in the next 5 to 10 years? Will it still be a family business?
Absolutely. I would like it to be a family business for one reason. I mean, certainly we are not contemplating selling out in any way. Of course, it's not that we haven't had offers, but for us, tea is our passion. And for us to see Dilma in the hands of someone who looks at it as a means of profit, that would be catastrophic. It would be completely contrary to anything that my father worked for. And also it would be contrary to the faith that we have had in building this business. And so for us, we see that a refocus on the fundamentals, on purity of origin, on what my father said at the beginning, what was laughed at the beginning, you know, on the single origin, on freshness. These are all concepts that he introduced to the tea category going back to the 50s, which it was, you know, tea was tea. And it was just, you put a bit of milk in it.
It's just a commodity, something you drink every day.
Exactly. But what he did was to help build tea as an experience. Mm-hmm. And that requires, particularly in this very complex millennial generation, for them, their mindset is very much aligned with not just one factor. It's not whether it's a luxury or not. It's a whole host of factors. Is the brand acceptable? Are they complying with my views on sustainability and so on? But on the second point of what you said, yes, tea is everything that you say it is in Sri Lanka, in Malaysia. You have your teh tarik, you have it strong, you have it sweet and milky, but it's also a luxury. It's an affordable luxury. But the important thing is the best tea for you is the tea that you enjoy, which means if you like it with milk, that's fine. But our job is to make sure that we give you the right tea, an intense, strong tea with the right milk, and maybe we suggest that you don't take too much sugar, you take it with a little bit of honey, try to keep it natural and so on. So I think these are the experiences that we're trying to build. And as I see the family taking the business forward, it's that which we will focus on. We have our tea lounges where someone can come and you can have tea cocktails, tea mocktails, tea paired with food, tea cooked in food. We work with chefs around the world. And this is wonderful. And that's what we're doing here in Malaysia.
Well, I get excited just like you talking about the possibilities with tea. Well, thank you so much, Dilhan, for speaking with me to talk about the story of your family and the business.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.